Chapter 1. Experts and Citizens. Washington, D.C. Citing years of frustration over their advice being misunderstood, misrepresented, or simply ignored, America's foremost experts in every field collectively tendered their resignation Monday. The Onion. A Nation of Explainers. We've all met them. They're our co-workers, our friends, our family members. They are young and old, rich and poor, some with education, others armed only with a laptop or a library card. But they all have one thing in common. They are ordinary people who believe they are actually troves of knowledge. Convinced that they are more informed than the experts, more broadly knowledgeable than the professors, and more insightful than the gullible masses, they are the explainers who are more than happy to enlighten the rest of us about everything from the history of imperialism to the dangers of vaccines. We accept such people and put up with them not least because we know that deep down, they usually mean well. We even have a certain affection for them. The 1980s television sitcom Cheers, for example, immortalized the character of Cliff Clavin, the Boston mailman and barfly who was an expert on everything. Cliff, like his real-life counterparts, prefaced every statement with, "Studies have shown," or, "It's a known fact." Viewers loved Cliff because everyone knew someone like him. The cranky uncle at a holiday dinner. The young student home from that crucial first year of college. We could find such people endearing because they were quirky exceptions in a country that otherwise respected and relied on the views of experts. But something has changed over the past few decades. The public space is increasingly dominated by a loose assortment of poorly informed people, many of them autodidacts, who are disdainful of formal education and dismissive of experience. If experience is necessary for being president, the cartoonist and author Scott Adams tweeted during the 2016 election, name a political topic I can't master in 1 hour under the tutelage of top experts, as though a discussion with an expert is like copying information from one computer drive to another. A kind of intellectual Gresham's Law is gathering momentum. Where once the rule was, bad money drives out good, we now live in an age where misinformation pushes aside knowledge. This is a very bad thing. A modern society cannot function without a social division of labor and a reliance on experts, professionals, and intellectuals. For the moment, I will use these three words interchangeably. No one is an expert on everything. No matter what our aspirations, we are bound by the reality of time and the undeniable limits of our talent. We prosper because we specialize, and because we develop both formal and informal mechanisms and practices that allow us to trust each other in those specializations. In the early 1970s, the science fiction writer Robert Heinlein issued a dictum, often quoted since, that specialization is for insects. Truly capable human beings, he wrote, should be able to do almost anything from changing a diaper to commanding a warship. It is a notable sentiment that celebrates human adaptability and resilience, but it's wrong. While there was once a time when every homesteader lumbered his own trees and built his own house, this not only was inefficient, but produced only rudimentary housing. There's a reason we don't do things that way anymore. When we build skyscrapers, we don't expect the metallurgist who knows what goes into a girder, the architect who designs the building, and the glazier who installs the windows to be the same person. That's why we can enjoy the view from 100 floors above a city. Each expert, although possessing some overlapping knowledge, respects the professional abilities of many others and concentrates on doing what he or she knows best. Their trust and cooperation lead to a final product greater than anything they could have produced alone. The fact of the matter is that we cannot function without admitting the limits of our knowledge and trusting in the expertise of others. We sometimes resist this conclusion because it undermines our sense of independence and autonomy. We want to believe we are capable of making all kinds of decisions, and we chafe at the person who corrects us or tells us we're wrong or instructs us in things we don't understand. This natural human reaction among individuals is dangerous when it becomes a shared characteristic among entire societies. Is this new? Is knowledge in more danger? And are conversation and debate really all that more difficult today than they were 50 or 100 years ago? Intellectuals are always complaining about the denseness of their fellow citizens, and laypeople have always distrusted the pointy heads and experts. How new is this problem, and how seriously should we take it? Some of this conflict in the public square is just so much predictable noise, now amplified by the internet and social media. The internet gathers factoids and half-baked ideas, and it then splays all that bad information and poor reasoning all over the electronic world. Imagine what the 1920s would have sounded like if every crank in every small town had his own radio station. Maybe it's not that people are any dumber or any less willing to listen to experts than they were 100 years ago. It's just that we can hear them all now. Besides, a certain amount of conflict between people who know some things and people who know other things is inevitable. There were probably arguments between the first hunters and gatherers over what to have for dinner. As various areas of human achievement became the province of professionals, disagreements were bound to grow and to become sharper. And as the distance between experts and the rest of the citizenry grew, so did the social gulf and the mistrust between them. All societies, no matter how advanced, have an undercurrent of resentment against educated elites, as well as persistent cultural attachments to folk wisdom, urban legends, and other irrational but normal human reactions to the complexity and confusion of modern life. Democracies, with their noisy public spaces, have always been especially prone to challenges to established knowledge. Actually, they're more prone to challenges to established anything. It's one of the characteristics that makes them democratic. Even in the ancient world, democracies were known for their fascination with change and progress. Thucydides, for example, described the democratic Athenians of the 5th century BC as a restless people addicted to innovation. And centuries later, St. Paul found that the Athenians spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. This kind of restless questioning of orthodoxy is celebrated and protected in a democratic culture. The United States, with its intense focus on the liberties of the individual, enshrines this resistance to intellectual authority even more than other democracies. Of course, no discussion about how Americans think is complete without an obligatory nod to Alexis de Tocqueville, the French observer who noted in 1835 that the denizens of the new United States were not exactly enamored of experts or their smarts. "In most of the operations of the mind," he wrote, "each American appeals only to the individual effort of his own understanding." This distrust of intellectual authority was rooted, Tocqueville theorized, in the nature of American democracy. "When citizens, placed on an equal footing, are all closely seen by one another," he wrote, "they are constantly brought back to their own reason as the most obvious and proximate source of truth. It is not only confidence in this or that man which is destroyed, but the disposition to trust the authority of any man whatsoever." Such observations have not been limited to early America. Teachers, experts, and professional knowers have been venting about a lack of deference from their societies since Socrates was forced to drink his hemlock. In more modern times, the Spanish philosopher, José Ortega y Gasset, in 1930, decried the revolt of the masses and the unfounded intellectual arrogance that characterized it. He wrote, "Thus, in the intellectual life, which of its essence requires and presupposes qualification, one can note the progressive triumph of the pseudo-intellectual, unqualified, unqualifiable, and by their very mental texture, disqualified. I may be mistaken, but the present-day writer, when he takes his pen in hand to treat a subject which he has studied deeply, has to bear in mind that the average reader, who has never concerned himself with his subject, if he reads, does so with the view, not of learning something from the writer, but rather of pronouncing judgment on him when he is not in agreement with the commonplaces that the said reader carries in his head." In terms that would not sound out of place in our current era, Ortega y Gasset attributed the rise of an increasingly powerful but increasingly ignorant public to many factors, including material affluence, prosperity, and scientific achievements. The American attachment to intellectual self-reliance, described by Tocqueville, survived for nearly a century before falling under a series of assaults, both from within and without. Technology, universal secondary education, the proliferation of specialized expertise, and the emergence of the United States as a global power in the mid-20th century, all undermined the idea, or more accurately, the myth, that the average American was adequately equipped either for the challenges of daily life or for running the affairs of a large country. Over a half century ago, the political scientist Richard Hofstadter wrote that the complexity of modern life has steadily whittled away the functions the ordinary citizen can intelligently and competently perform for himself. In the original American populistic dream, the omnicompetence of the common man was fundamental and indispensable. It was believed that he could, without much special preparation, pursue the professions and run the government. Today he knows that he cannot even make his breakfast without using devices, more or less mysterious to him, which expertise has put at his disposal. And when he sits down to breakfast and looks at his morning newspaper, he reads about a whole range of issues and acknowledges, if he is candid with himself, that he has not acquired competence to judge most of them. Hofstadter argued, and this was back in 1963, that this overwhelming complexity produced feelings of helplessness and anger among a citizenry that knew itself increasingly to be at the mercy of smarter elites. What used to be a jocular and usually benign ridicule of intellect and formal training has turned into a malign resentment of the intellectual in his capacity as expert, Hofstadter warned. Once the intellectual was gently ridiculed because he was not needed, now he is fiercely resented because he is needed too much. 50 years later, the law professor, Ilya Somin, pointedly described how little had changed. Like Hofstadter before him, Somin wrote in 2015 that the size and complexity of government have made it more difficult for voters with limited knowledge to monitor and evaluate the government's many activities. The result is a polity in which the people often cannot exercise their sovereignty responsibly and effectively. More disturbing is that Americans have done little in those intervening decades to remedy the gap between their own knowledge and the level of information required to participate in an advanced democracy. The low level of political knowledge in the American electorate, Somin correctly notes, is still one of the best established findings in social science. So it's not new. Is it even a problem? People who specialize in particular subjects are prone to think that others should be as interested in it as they are. But really, who needs to know all this stuff? Most experts in international affairs have difficulty passing a map test outside of their area of specialization. So, what's the harm if the average person has no idea how to nail the exact location of Kazakhstan? After all, when the Rwandan genocide broke out in 1994, future Secretary of State Warren Christopher had to be shown a location of Rwanda. So, why should the rest of us walk around carrying that kind of trivia in our heads? No one can master that much information. We do our best, and when we need to find something out, we consult the best sources we can find. I remember asking my high school chemistry teacher, a man I was certain knew everything, for the atomic number of a certain element off the top of his head, in part to challenge him, but mostly because I was too lazy to look it up myself. He raised an eyebrow and said that he didn't know. He then gestured over his shoulder at the periodic table of elements posted on the wall and said, "This is why scientists use charts, Tom." Without doubt, some of these expert complaints about laypeople are unfair. Even the most attentive parent, the most informed shopper, or the most civic-minded voter cannot keep up with the flood of news about everything from childhood nutrition to product safety to trade policy. If ordinary citizens could absorb all of that information, they wouldn't need experts in the first place. The death of expertise, however, is a different problem than the historical fact of low levels of information among laypeople. The issue is not indifference to established knowledge, it's the emergence of a positive hostility to such knowledge. This is new in American culture, and it represents the aggressive replacement of expert views or established knowledge with the insistence that every opinion on any matter is as good as every other. This is a remarkable change in our public discourse. This change is not only unprecedented, but dangerous. The distrust of experts and the more general anti-intellectual attitudes that go with it are problems that should be getting better, but instead are getting worse. When Professor Soman and others note that the public's ignorance is no worse than it was a half century ago, this in itself should be a cause for alarm, if not panic. Holding the line isn't good enough. In fact, the line may not be holding at all. The death of expertise actually threatens to reverse the gains of years of knowledge among people who now assume they know more than they actually do. This is a threat to the material and civic well-being of citizens in a democracy. It would be easy to dismiss a distrust of established knowledge by attributing it to the stereotype of suspicious, uneducated yokels rejecting the big city ways of the mysterious eggheads. But again, the reality is far more unsettling. Campaigns against established knowledge are being led by people who should know better. In the case of vaccines, for example, low rates of participation in child vaccination programs are actually not a problem among small-town mothers with little schooling. Those mothers have to accept vaccinations for their kids because of the requirements in the public schools. The parents more likely to resist vaccines, as it turns out, are found among educated San Francisco suburbanites in Marin County. While these mothers and fathers are not doctors, they are educated just enough to believe they have the background to challenge established medical science. Thus, in a counterintuitive irony, educated parents are actually making worse decisions than those with far less schooling, and they are putting everyone's children at risk. Indeed, ignorance has become hip, with some Americans now wearing their rejection of expert advice as a badge of cultural sophistication. Consider, for example, the raw milk movement, a fad among gourmands who advocate the right to ingest untreated dairy products. In 2012, The New Yorker reported on this trend, noting that raw milk stirs the hedonism of food lovers in a special way. Because it is not heated or homogenized and often comes from animals raised on pasture, it tends to be richer and sweeter and sometimes to retain a whiff of the farm, the slightly discomforting flavor known to connoisseurs as cow butt. Pasteurization strips away layers of complexity, layers of aromatics. Daniel Patterson, a chef who has used raw milk to make custard and eggless ice cream at Koi, his 2-Michelin-star restaurant in San Francisco, said. Chef Patterson is an expert in the preparation of food, and there's no arguing with his or anyone else's palate. But while pasteurization may affect the taste of milk, it also strips away pathogens that can kill human beings. The raw milk movement is not some on-the-edge experience plumbed by a few exotic chefs. Raw milk adherents argue not only that untreated dairy products taste good, but also that they are healthier and better for human beings. After all, if raw vegetables are better for us, why not raw everything? Why not eat the way nature intended us to and go back to a purer, simpler time? It may have been a simpler time, but it was also a time when people routinely died of food-borne diseases. Still, it's a free country, and if fully informed adult gastronomes want to risk a trip to the hospital for the scent of a cow's nether regions in their coffee, that's their choice. I'm not one to judge this too harshly, since my favorite dishes include raw shellfish and steak tartare, items whose menu disclaimers always make me feel as if I'm ordering contraband. Still, while raw meat and raw shellfish carry risks, they are not dietary staples, and especially not for children, for whom raw milk is outright hazardous. In short order, doctors at the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, tried to get involved to no avail. The CDC issued a report in 2012 that noted that raw dairy products were 150 times more likely than pasteurized products to cause foodborne illness. A Food and Drug Administration expert put it as bluntly as possible, calling the consumption of raw dairy the food equivalent of Russian roulette. None of this has swayed people who not only continue to ingest untreated products, but who insist on giving it to the consumers who have no choice or ability to understand the debate. Their children. Why listen to doctors about raw milk? After all, they've gotten other things wrong. When it comes to food, for example, Americans for decades have been told to limit their consumption of eggs and certain kinds of fats. Government experts told people to limit their intake of red meat, increase the role of grains in their diet, and in general, stay away from anything that tastes good. That last one, I admit, is how I interpreted those recommendations. Years later, it turned out that eggs are not only harmless, they might even be good for you. Margarine turned out to be worse for us than butter, and a few glasses of wine each day might be better than teetotaling. So there it is. The doctors were wrong. Is it time to break out the bacon cheeseburgers and pour another martini? Not quite. The debate about eggs isn't over, but to focus on one aspect of the American diet is to miss the point. The doctors may have been mistaken about the specific impact of eggs, but they're not wrong that a steady diet of fast food, washed down with a sugary soda or a six-pack of beer, isn't good for you. Some folks seized on the news about eggs, much as they did on a bogus story about chocolate being a healthy snack that made the rounds earlier, to rationalize never listening to doctors, who clearly have a better track record than the average overweight American at keeping people alive with healthier diets. At the root of all this is an inability among laypeople to understand that experts being wrong on occasion about certain issues is not the same thing as experts being wrong consistently on everything. The fact of the matter is that experts are more often right than wrong, especially on essential matters of fact. And yet, the public constantly searches for the loopholes in expert knowledge that will allow them to disregard all expert advice they don't like. In part, this is because human nature, as we'll find out, tends to search for those loopholes in everything. But equally, if not more important, is that when experts and professionals are wrong, the consequences can be catastrophic. Raise the issue of medical advice, for example, and you will almost certainly find someone who will throw out the word thalidomide as though it is a self-explanatory rejoinder. It's been decades since the introduction of thalidomide, a drug once thought safe that was given to pregnant women as a sedative. No one realized at the time that thalidomide also caused horrendous birth defects, and pictures of children with missing or deformed limbs haunted the public imagination for many years afterward. The drug's name has become synonymous with expert failure to this day. No one is arguing, however, that experts can't be wrong, a subject we'll discuss in this book. Rather, the point is that they are less likely to be wrong than non-experts. The same people who anxiously point back in history to the thalidomide disaster routinely pop dozens of drugs into their mouths, from aspirin to antihistamines, which are among the thousands and thousands of medications shown to be safe by decades of trials and tests conducted by experts. It rarely occurs to the skeptics that for every terrible mistake, there are countless successes that prolong their lives. Sometimes, second-guessing the professionals can turn into an obsession, with tragic results. In 2015, a Massachusetts accountant named Stephen Pescari lost his 78-year-old mother to cardiovascular disease. Mrs. Pescari had a long history of health trouble, including emphysema, and died after an operation to repair a heart valve. Pescari, however, was convinced that one of his mother's doctors, Michael Davidson, the director of endovascular cardiac surgery at a top Boston hospital and a professor at Harvard Medical School, had ignored warnings about a particular drug given to Pescari's mother. In a literal case of the death of expertise, the accountant showed up at the hospital and shot the doctor to death. He then killed himself after leaving behind a flash drive with his research about the drug. Obviously, Stephen Pescari was a disturbed man, unhinged by the death of his mother. but a few minutes of conversations with professionals in any field will yield similar, if less dramatic, stories. Doctors routinely tussle with patients over drugs. Lawyers will describe clients losing money, and sometimes their freedom, because of unheeded advice. Teachers will relate stories of parents insisting that their children's exam answers are right even when they're demonstrably wrong. Realtors tell of clients who bought houses against their experienced advice and ended up trapped in a money pit. No area of American life is immune to the death of expertise. The American public's declining capabilities in science and mathematics are enabling multiple public health crises, from obesity to childhood diseases. Meanwhile, in the worlds of politics and public policy, where at least some familiarity with history, civics, and geography is crucial to informed debate, attacks on established knowledge have reached frightening proportions. The rise of the low-information voter. Political debate and the making of public policy are not science. They are rooted in conflict, sometimes conducted as respectful disagreement, but more often as a hockey game with no referees and a standing invitation for spectators to rush onto the ice. In modern America, policy debates sound increasingly like fights between groups of ill-informed people who all manage to be wrong at the same time. Those political leaders who manage to be smarter than the public, and there seem to be fewer of those lately, wade into these Donnybrooks and contradict their constituents at their own peril. There are many examples of these brawls among what pundits and analysts gently refer to now as low-information voters. Whether about science or policy, however, they all share the same disturbing characteristic: a solipsistic and thin-skinned insistence that every opinion be treated as truth. Americans no longer distinguish the phrase, "you're wrong," from the phrase, "you're stupid." To disagree is to disrespect. To correct another is to insult. And to refuse to acknowledge all views as worthy of consideration, no matter how fantastic or inane they are, is to be close-minded. The epidemic of ignorance in public policy debates has real consequences for the quality of life and well-being of every American. During the debate in 2009 over the Affordable Care Act, for example, at least half of all Americans believed claims by opponents like former Republican vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin that the legislation included death panels that would decide who gets health care based on a bureaucratic decision about a patient's worthiness to live. 4 years later, almost a third of surgeons apparently continued to believe this. Nearly half of Americans also thought the ACA established a uniform government health plan. Love it or hate it, the program does none of these things. And 2 years after the bill passed, at least 40% of Americans weren't even sure the program was still in force as law. Legislation is complicated, and it's perhaps unreasonable to ask Americans to grasp the details of a bill their own representatives seem unable to understand. Then-House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, wilting under a barrage of perfectly reasonable questions in 2011, clearly didn't know what was in the ACA either, and she blurted out her widely quoted admission that the Congress would have to pass the bill to find out what's in it. Other complicated initiatives have produced similar confusion. Taxes are another good example of how public ignorance influences national debates. Everybody hates taxes. Everybody complains about them. And every spring, the hideous complexity of the U.S. tax code produces a fair amount of anxiety among honest citizens who, at best, end up guessing at the right answers when trying to pay their levy. The sad reality, however, is that the average American has no real idea how his or her money is spent. Polls upon polls show not only that Americans generally feel government spends too much and taxes them too highly, but also that they are consistently wrong about who pays taxes, how much they pay, and where the money goes. This, despite the fact that information about the budget of the United States is more accessible than the days when the government would have to mail a document the size of a cinder block to the few voters who wanted to see it. Or consider foreign aid. This is a hot-button issue among some Americans who deride foreign aid as wasted money. Americans routinely believe, on average, that more than 25% of the national budget is given away as largesse in the form of foreign aid. In reality, that guess is not only wrong, but wildly wrong. Foreign aid is a small fraction of the budget, less than 0.75% of the total expenditures of the United States of America. Only 5% of Americans know this. 1 in 10 Americans, meanwhile, think that more than half of the U.S. budget, that is, several trillion dollars, is given away annually to other countries. Most think that no matter how much it is, it's given as a check worth cold cash. That's also wrong. Foreign aid, in fact, might even qualify as a jobs program, since much of it is given in the form of products, from food to military aircraft, actually purchased by the government from Americans and then sent to other nations. To argue that foreign aid is a waste of money is a comprehensible political position. I and other experts might say that such a blanket objection is unwise, but it is at least a position rooted in principle rather than based on an error of fact. To object to foreign aid because of a mistaken belief that it constitutes a quarter of the U.S. budget, however, almost immediately defeats any sensible discussion right at the outset. This level of ignorance can get pretty expensive. Americans tend to support national missile defenses against nuclear attack, for example, in part because many believe the United States already has them. This is a public misconception going back decades, long before the United States fielded the small number of interceptors now operational in Alaska. Whether such systems will work or whether they should be built are now largely irrelevant questions. What began as a program aimed at the Soviet Union during the Cold War in the 1980s is now enshrined in the popular imagination and supported by both Republicans and Democrats to the tune of billions of dollars. The overall problem here isn't among people who have genuine concerns about possible side effects from vaccines, or who might be conflicted about whether to build defenses against nuclear attack. Reasoned skepticism is essential, not only to science, but also to a healthy democracy. Instead, the death of expertise is more like a national bout of ill temper, a childish rejection of authority in all its forms, coupled to an insistence that strongly held opinions are indistinguishable from facts. Experts are supposed to clear up this kind of confusion, or at least to serve as guides through the thicket of confusion issues. But who are the real experts? Before we move on to discuss the sources of the campaign against established knowledge and why we're in such a pickle at a time when citizens should be more informed and engaged than ever before, we need to think about how we divide experts or intellectuals from the rest of the population. Expert is an overused label, of course. Every business proclaims itself the yard care experts or the carpet cleaning experts. And while that has some meaning, surgeons and carpet cleaners are not the same kind of expert. Intellectual and academic are, more than ever, terms of derision in America. Let's untangle some of this before we proceed. Experts and citizens. So, who's an expert? What constitutes expertise? A lot of people declare that they're experts or intellectuals, and sometimes they are. On the other hand, self-identification can be worse than misleading. People who claim to be experts are sometimes only about as self-aware as people who think they're good kissers. Dictionaries aren't much help here. Most define experts in a rather circular way as people who have comprehensive and authoritative knowledge, which is another way of describing people whose command of a subject means that the information they provide the rest of us is true and can be trusted. How do we know it can be trusted? Because experts tell us so. As Justice Potter Stewart once said of pornography, expertise is one of those things that's difficult to define, but we usually know it when we see it. There are lots of experts in this world. Some are easy to spot. Medical doctors, engineers, and airline pilots are experts. as our film directors and concert pianists, athletes and their coaches are experts, but so are plumbers, police officers, and carpenters. For that matter, your local mail carrier is an expert, at least in his own field. If you need a blood test interpreted, you should ask a doctor or a nurse, but if you'd like to know exactly how a letter from your friend in Brazil got to your door in Michigan, you might ask someone who's been handling that responsibility for years. Specialized knowledge is inherent in every occupation, and so here I will use the words professionals, intellectuals, and experts interchangeably, in the broader sense of people who have mastered particular skills or bodies of knowledge and who practice those skills or use that knowledge as their main occupation in life. This helps us to distinguish the professional pilot from the weekend flyer, or even a professional gambler from the hapless mark who occasionally hands money to a casino. Put another way, experts are the people who know considerably more on a subject than the rest of us, and are those to whom we turn when we need advice, education, or solutions in a particular area of human knowledge. Note that this does not mean that experts know all there is to know about something. Rather, it means that experts in any given subject are, by their nature, a minority whose views are more likely to be authoritative, that is, correct or accurate, than anyone else's. And even among experts, there are experts. A doctor with a newly minted MD is far more qualified than any layperson to diagnose and treat a disease, but when faced by a puzzling case, he or she may in turn defer to a specialist. A practicing attorney and a Supreme Court justice are both lawyers, but the one in the black robes in Washington is more likely to be an expert on constitutional issues than the one handling wills and divorces for a small community. Of course, experience counts, too. In 2009, when a U.S. air flight in New York City was crippled on takeoff by striking a flock of birds, there were two pilots in the cockpit, but the more expert captain, with many more hours of flying time, said, "My aircraft," and guided the jet to a water ditching in the Hudson River. Everyone aboard survived. One reason claims of expertise grate on people in a democracy is that specialization is necessarily exclusive. When we study a certain area of knowledge or spend our lives in a particular occupation, we not only forego expertise in other jobs or subjects, but also trust that other people in the community know what they're doing in their area as surely as we do in our own. As much as we might want to go up to the cockpit after the engine flames out to give the pilot some helpful tips, we assume, in part because we have to, that they're better able to cope with the problem than we are. Otherwise, our highly evolved society breaks down into islands of incoherence, where we spend our time in poorly informed second-guessing instead of trusting each other. So how do we distinguish these experts among us, and how do we identify them? True expertise, the kind of knowledge on which others rely, is an intangible but recognizable combination of education, talent, experience, and peer affirmation. Each of these is a mark of expertise, but most people would rightly judge how all of them are combined in any given subject or professional field when deciding whose advice to trust. Formal training or education is the most obvious mark of expert status and the easiest to identify, but it is only a start. For many professions, credentials are necessary for entry into a field. Teachers, nurses, and plumbers all have to have certification of some kind to exercise their skills, as a signal to others that their abilities have been reviewed by their peers and met a basic standard of competence. While some of the most determined opponents of established knowledge deride this as mere credentialism, these degrees and licenses are tangible signs of achievement, and important markers that help the rest of us separate hobbyists, or charlatans, from true experts. To be fair, some of these credentials are new inventions, and some of them might not matter very much. In some cases, credentials are made up by states and localities as revenue gimmicks, while others affirm no skill other than passing a test once and then never again. Lawyers in modern America complete a law degree, but in earlier times young men merely read law and then had to pass admittance to their state's bar. While this less formal system produced a man of greatness like Abraham Lincoln, and by all accounts, he wasn't that competent an attorney, it also produced lesser lights, such as Henry Billings Brown, the Supreme Court justice who wrote the majority opinion in the separate but equal Plessy versus Ferguson decision. Brown attended courses in law at both Harvard and Yale, but did not graduate from either of them. Still, credentials are a start. They carry the imprimatur of the institutions that bestow them, and they are a signal of quality, just as consumer brands tend to promote and hopefully to protect the quality of their products. Look carefully at an actual college degree and note what most of them actually say: that the bearer has been examined by the faculty and admitted to the degree, which in turn is backed by a committee of schools in that region or a body representing a particular profession. Those faculties and the associations who accredit their courses of study are in effect vouching for the graduate's knowledge of a particular subject. The name of the school or institution, no less than the degree holder, is on the line, at least as an initial affirmation of capability. There is no denying that good colleges have graduated a lot of people without a lick of common sense. Lesser institutions have likewise produced geniuses, but as the saying goes, while the race may not always be to the swift, that's the way to bet. The track record for genius production from MIT or Georgia Tech is demonstrably higher than for less competitive schools or self-educated inventors. Still, MIT has also produced people who not only can't balance a checkbook, but who aren't very good engineers. What makes the experts, especially the prominent leaders in their specialization, stand apart from others with similar credentials? One difference is aptitude, or natural talent. Talent is indispensable to an expert. As Ernest Hemingway once said about writing, real seriousness in regard to writing is one of two absolute necessities. The other, unfortunately, is talent. The person who studied Chaucer in college is going to know more than most other people about English literature in some purely factual way. But the scholar who has a real talent for the study of medieval literature not only knows more, but can explain it coherently and perhaps even generate new knowledge on the subject. Talent separates those who have gained a credential from people who have a deeper feel or understanding of their area of expertise. Every field has maze-bright achievers who, as it turns out, are not good at their jobs. There are brilliant law students who freeze in front of a jury. Some of the high scorers on a police examination have no street smarts and will never develop them. A fair number of new holders of doctorates from top universities will never write another thing of consequence after laboring through a dissertation. These people may have cleared the wickets of entry to a profession, but they're not very good at it, and their expertise will likely never exceed the natural limitation of their own abilities. This is where experience helps to separate the credentialed from the incompetent. Sometimes markets themselves winnow out untalented or unskilled would-be experts. While professional stockbrokers make mistakes, for example, most manage to make a living. Amateur day traders, however, almost never make money. Business Insider CEO and former Wall Street analyst Henry Blodgett once called amateur day trading the dumbest job there is, and that most people who engage in it would make more money working at Burger King. Eventually, they run out of cash. Likewise, bad teachers over time will tend to get bad evaluations, lousy lawyers will lose clients, and untalented athletes will fail to make the cut. Every field has its trials by fire, and not everyone survives them, which is why experience and longevity in a particular area or profession are reasonable markers of expertise. Indeed, asking about experience is another way of asking the age-old question, "What have you done lately?" Experts stay engaged in their field, continually improve their skills, learn from their mistakes, and have visible track records. Over the span of their career, they get better, or at least maintain their high level of competence and couple it to the wisdom, again, and intangible, that comes from time. There are many examples of the role of experience and expertise. Experienced law enforcement officers often have an instinct for trouble that their younger colleagues miss, an intuition they can explain only as a sense that something isn't right. Doctors or pilots who've experienced and survived multiple crises in the operating theater or the cockpit are less likely to be panicked by adversity than their newer colleagues. Veteran teachers are less intimidated by challenging or difficult students. Stand-up comedians who've done a lot of gigs on the road do not fear hecklers and even know how to use them as raw material for more laughs. These are not always quantifiable skills. Here's an example from my own education and field of study. After college, I went on to the Harriman Institute at Columbia University for further study in the politics of the Soviet Union. This was part of my own credentialing. I wanted to teach and work on Soviet affairs, and Columbia was one of the best schools in that field at the time. The director of the institute was a professor named Marshall Shulman, a well-known Sovietologist who had also served in Jimmy Carter's White House as an advisor on Soviet matters. Like all Sovietologists, Shulman studied the Soviet press very carefully for indications of policy positions within the Kremlin. This process was an almost Talmudic exercise in textual analysis, and it was a mystery to those of us who had never done it. How, we students asked him, did he make sense of any of the stilted prose of Soviet newspapers, or divine any meaning from such turgid passages? How could 1,000 formulaic stories on the heroic struggles of collective farms illuminate the secrets of one of the most closed systems on Earth? Shulman shrugged and said, I can't really explain it. I just read Pravda until my nose twitches. At the time, I thought that this was one of the stupidest things I'd ever heard. I even started to wonder if I'd made a poor life choice investing in further education. What Shulman meant, however, is that he'd spent years reading Soviet periodicals, and thus he had become so attuned to their method of communication that he could spot changes or irregularities when they passed before his trained and experienced eye. Although skeptical, I did the same throughout my schooling and into the early years of my career. I read Soviet materials almost daily and tried to see the patterns in them that were previously invisible to me. Eventually, I came to understand what Shulman meant. I can't say that my nose twitched or my ears wiggled, but I realized that reading things from a foreign country in a foreign language was a specific kind of expertise. It could not be distilled into a course or a test. There was no quick means to develop it as a skill. It took time, practice, and advice from more experienced experts in the field. Another mark of true experts is their acceptance of evaluation and correction by other experts. Every professional group and expert community has watchdogs, boards, accreditors, and certification authorities whose job it is to police its own members and to ensure not only that they live up to the standards of their own specialty, but also that their arts are practiced only by people who actually know what they're doing. This self-policing is central to the concept of professionalism, and is another way we can identify experts. Every specialized group creates barriers to entry into their profession. Some of these barriers are more reasonable and honest than others, but usually they are grounded in the need to ensure that the name of the profession isn't devalued by incompetence or fraud. I could gather together a handful of colleagues, hang a shingle outside my home, and call it the Tom Nichols Institute of High Energy Physics. But the fact of the matter is that I don't know a thing about high energy physics. That's why my notional institute would never be accredited by real physicists, who would not take kindly to me printing up phony degrees, and who in short order would seek to close me down to protect the meaning of the word physicist. Expert communities rely on these peer-run institutions to maintain standards and to enhance social trust. Mechanisms like peer review, board certification, professional associations, and other organizations and professions help to protect quality and to assure society, that is, the experts' clients, that they're safe in accepting expert claims of competence. When you take an elevator to the top floor of a tall building, the certificate in the elevator does not say, "Good luck up there." It says that a civic authority, relying on engineers, educated, and examined by other engineers, I've looked at that box and know, with as much certainty as anyone can, that you'll be safe. Experience and professional affirmation matter, but it's also true that there is considerable wisdom in the old Chinese warning to beware a craftsman who claims 20 years of experience when in reality he's only had 1 year of experience 20 times. There are bad dentists who are lousy at pulling teeth when they graduated from dentistry school and who do not get much better at it before retirement. There are teachers who induce narcolepsy in their students on the first day of their class, just as they do on their last. But we should remember two important things about experts, even ones who might not be the best in their field. First, while our clumsy dentist might not be the best tooth puller in town, he or she is better at it than you. We don't all need the dean of the dentistry school for a crown or a simple cavity. You might be able to get lucky once and pull a tooth, but you're not educated or experienced enough to do it without a great deal of risk. Most people won't even cut their own hair. Beauticians, after all, handle all kinds of chemicals and sharp objects, and they are another group that requires training and licensing. Few of us are going to risk taking out our own teeth or those of our loved ones. Second, and related to this point about relative skill, experts will make mistakes, but they are far less likely to make mistakes than a layperson. This is a crucial distinction between experts and everyone else, in that experts know better than anyone the pitfalls of their own profession. As the renowned physicist Werner Heisenberg once put it, an expert is someone who knows some of the worst mistakes that can be made in his subject and how to avoid them. His fellow physicist, Niels Bohr, had a different take, saying, an expert is someone who has made all the mistakes which can be made in a very narrow field. Both of these points should help us to understand why the pernicious idea that everyone could be an expert is so dangerous. It's true in a relative sense that almost anyone with particular skills can develop specialized knowledge to which others, in most circumstances, must defer. Trouble, however, rears its head when people start to believe that knowing a little bit about something means expertise. It's a thin line between the hobbyist who knows a lot about warships from reading Jane's Fighting Ships and an actual expert on the capabilities of the world's naval vessels. But that line nonetheless exists. Knowing things is not the same as understanding them. Comprehension is not the same thing as analysis. Expertise is not a parlor game played with factoids. And while there are self-trained experts, they are rare exceptions. More common are the people seeking quick entry into complicated fields but who have no idea how poor their efforts are. They're like the moderately entertaining karaoke singers who think they have a chance to become the next winner of American Idol, or the scratch golfers who think they might take a shot at going pro. Doing something well is not the same thing as becoming a trusted source of advice or learning about a subject. And notice that the same people who think they can become singers never think they can become voice coaches. This lack of self-awareness and intellectual limits can produce some awkward interactions between experts and laypeople. Some years ago, for example, I had a call from a gentleman who insisted that he had some important work that might be of use in our curriculum at the Naval War College. He'd been referred to me by a former student at another school, and he very much wanted me to read an important article about the Middle East. I asked, who wrote the piece? Well, he answered, he did. He was a businessman, and he'd read a lot. I asked if he'd had any training in the subject, visited the region, or read any of the languages of the Middle East. He had no such background, he admitted, and then said, but after all, you can become an expert reading a book a month, right? Wrong. American culture tends to fuel these kinds of romantic notions about the wisdom of the common person, or the gumption of the self-educated genius. These images empower a certain kind of satisfying social fantasy, in which ordinary people outperform the stuffy professor or the nerdy scientist through sheer grit and ingenuity. There are plenty of examples of this in American popular culture, especially in films that depict remarkably bright young people outsmarting businesses, universities, and even governments. In 1997, for example, Ben Affleck and Matt Damon scripted a film called Good Will Hunting, about a janitor who turns out to be a secret prodigy. In what is now an iconic scene, Damon growls out a chowdery Boston working man's accent and faces down an effete, ponytailed Ivy League graduate student in a bar, saying, "You're a first-year grad student. You just got finished reading some Marxian history, Pete Garrison probably. You're going to be convinced of that till next month when you get to James Lemon. Then you're going to be talking about how the economies of Virginia and Pennsylvania were entrepreneurial and capitalist way back in 1740. That's going to last until next year. You're going to be in here regurgitating Gordon Wood, talking about, you know, the pre-revolutionary utopia and the capitalist-forming effects of military mobilization. You got that from Vickers. Work in Essex County, page 98, right? Yeah, I read that too. Were you going to plagiarize the whole thing for us? Do you have any thoughts of your own on this matter? You dropped $150,000 on an education you could have got for $1.50 in late charges at the public library." Later, the young man fences with his psychotherapist about the works of Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky. Stilted and silly, these moments nonetheless resonated with moviegoers at the time. Damon and Affleck went home with Oscars for the screenplay, and no doubt they encouraged at least some viewers to believe that reading enough books is almost like going to school. In the end, expertise is difficult to define, and experts are sometimes hard to tell from dilettantes. Still, we should be able to distinguish between people who have a passing acquaintance with a subject and people whose knowledge is definitive. No one's knowledge is complete, and experts realize this better than anyone. But education, training, practice, experience, and acknowledgement by others in the same field should provide us with at least a rough guide to dividing experts from the rest of society. One of the most basic reasons experts and laypeople have always driven each other crazy is because they're all human beings. That is, they all share similar problems in the way they absorb and interpret information. Even the most educated people can make elementary mistakes in reasoning, while less intelligent people are prone to overlook the limitations in their own abilities. Expert or layperson, our brains work, or sometimes don't, in similar ways. We hear things the way we want to hear them, and we reject facts we don't like. Those problems are the subject of the next chapter.